Not necessarily was politically.
I surely don't need to tell you.
Has it really changed your life?
You've let somebody drill into your Merry Christmas! Put on your party hats and jingle those bells because the holiday season is upon us. I'm Kate Monaghan and you're listening to Ouch Talk Show number 103 for December 2013. And here's Rob Crosson to tell us what's coming up.
Bah humbug to you, Kate Monaghan. Christmas is the most miserable time of year. But Charlotte Walker and Kevin Healy, who are two people who agree with me entirely on this, will join us shortly.
Hannah Cockcroft is also with us in about 20 minutes' time. We'll be asking her about life after London 2012, being a student and learning to tie her shoelaces.
And I'm pleased to report that once again we will be talking about sex this month, sex education
favourite
for
subject.
Disabled people, to be exact, indeed. Ex-GMTV love Dr. Sam Van Rood will be along for a chat, as will Claire and Victoria from theatre company Them Wifeys, who teach sex ed to learning disabled women via a cloth figure called, Josephine.
Josephine. Anyway, 11-year-old Finian plays us out with a Christmas song that he wrote himself. He has Asperger's and has been pushing hard to get it into that much coveted number one spot for Christmas. Stay tuned.
Ouch! Disability Talk from the BBC with Rob Crosson and Kate Monaghan.
So last month, myself, Simon and Tim decided on what the killer question we ask every guest should be. And it is, would you get rid of your disability if you possibly had the choice? Now, we came up with this, Kate, but with the shock of your absence, I completely forgot to put it to the rest of the guests last month.
Were you crying too much?
I was crying. Yeah, it was crying. It was just scratching,
weeping,
general
wailing.
Outbreak of hives. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I think we should ask our two guests. First of all, award-winning mental health blogger Charlotte, who's recently just won one of the Mind Media Awards for her blog.
Massive congratulations, Charlotte.
Yeah, huge congrats. It's amazing.
Thank you.
If you could get rid of your disability, would you?
I always find this a really hard question because I have bipolar disorder, but I had quite a young onset, so around 11, 12 years of age. So all that kind of really formative time when you're learning who you are and developing friendships and thinking about what you want to do as an adult, I had bipolar for all of that time. So it's very, I can't just call it an illness and see it as something separate from me. I don't know what my personality would be like without it, and that's a bit scary.
Yeah.
So it would be essentially like embracing a complete stranger. You would no longer be Charlotte. Is that how you feel if you didn't have bipolar?
Because although the label bipolar covers such a massive range of potential symptoms and problems, there is a bit of a kind of bipolar personality. Maybe quite outgoing, maybe sociable, lots of ideas, that kind of thing. And I would hate to lose that bit of myself. But I did put the question to my partner once, whether he thought it was something I am, whether I am bipolar, or it's something I have. And he just looked at me like, OK, now you've really lost it, and said, it's something you suffer from, because that's his perspective. But that's completely different to mine.
That's a really hard phrase to get my head around, is the idea of suffering being an innate part of any disability. I mean, does this annoy you slightly?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose sometimes I don't like the phrase mental illness, for example, because you can't call bipolar a mental illness. Sometimes it's a condition that makes me ill, but sometimes it's a condition that has quite good bits. And sometimes I'm completely in remission with no symptoms, but I still have it. It's never going to go away. So, yeah, I find things like suffering illness quite problematic, although clearly I do suffer at times.
Okay. You've done a fantastic job of not answering the question.
Yep.
Can I force you on this, or do you have to defer?
I don't think I could say that I would get rid of it.
So we're taking it as a no from Charlotte.
Kevin.
Now on the line we have autism campaigner Kevin. Hello, Kevin.
Hi.
Hi. So if we can put the same question to you, would you get rid of your disability if you had the choice?
Well, that's a really difficult question. I think, you know, I look at me as me. I am me. Obviously, I've got autism. And if you take away the autism, then I suppose you take away, you know, it's a bit hard to comprehend, really. You know, if I take away the autism and, you know, It's a really difficult question.
Well, yeah, Rob, that's why they call it your killer
the
question.
The killer question, yeah. Because people would rather die than answer it, quite clearly. Now, just tell us a little bit about Kevin. We'll come back to you in a moment, Kevin. Kevin is an autism campaigner who was bullied online for being autistic to the point where he launched a campaign to change the relevant hate crime laws. So we'll come back to you in a minute, Kevin, if that's all right. But just for the moment, let's go on to the news which broke this month of an Italian woman who was reportedly forced to undergo a cesarean section and give her baby up for adoption while in the UK because of fears for her mental health. Now, we can't talk about this case due to legal constraints, but what we can discuss are the conversations it sparked both inside and outside the disability community about people with mental health diagnoses and parenting. Charlotte, let's go back to you on this. Can you tell me a little bit about your experiences of being a mother with mental health issues?
Sure. Well, I got married young by choice and wanted to have my kids young.
How young?
Just turned 20 when we got married, and I just about held on until we'd finished. Well, actually, I'd finished my degree. My ex-husband was catching up, and then we went ahead and had our first baby. And because it says in every mother and baby book, you know, watch out for postnatal depression, and I already had that history throughout my adolescence, I thought I'd be bound to have really bad postnatal depression. But I kind of completely got away with it. It was fine. And the first year of my son's life was just really a very good year for me. Mm. Unfortunately, then when I went on to have my second pregnancy, things were really difficult right from the pregnancy when I was very, very depressed. Just after I had my daughter, I was hypomanic. That's kind of like a smaller version of mania. Not wanting to sleep, rushing around, doing all the housework, telling everybody, no, you sit down, cuddle the baby, and I'll rush around and put the Christmas tree up and make the dinner. And
when you have that sensation, is it with a feeling of almost joy and happiness, or is it sort of grim fortitude?
It can be both. That's one of the things interesting that people don't really understand about a bipolar high. Sometimes, yeah, it's elation. Mm. And sometimes I feel like the top of my head's going to kind of fly off from the euphoria. And then I start thinking things like, why am I taking pills to stop this? You know, people go and buy pills illegally to take to feel like this. That's crazy. But also sometimes I can have that same sense of being very energetic, a bit kind of driven, and it can become quite unpleasant because I don't have those euphoric feelings and I feel like, okay, I'd like to stop now and sit down and be quiet, but my brain won't let me. It just wants to go on and on and on.
But so it did stop eventually. Then you had a huge down, I presume.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the typical pattern, whether treated or untreated, to get somebody out of a high usually, unfortunately, involves them having a big down. So then for most of the kind of first year of my daughter's life, I was very, very low, and it was very hard on all of us.
So did you think about all of these kinds of things when you made the decision to have children in the first place? What were you thinking about when you made that decision?
I just felt like it was a kind of a something I needed to do. I really, really wanted to have kids, but I did have a part of me that thought, you know, maybe all this lying around in bed for days saying that you can't get up and wash, maybe that's not depression, maybe that's just kind of laziness. And if you had a baby to look after, you couldn't be so self-indulgent. You'd have to get up, you'd have to make sure you were both clean and dressed, that you'd had something to eat. And then I suppose the experience of having my daughter showed how ridiculous,
That time, that this low period after your daughter was born, did you feel that basic innate protectiveness which mothers are supposed to feel towards their children, did you lose that?
I lost it a little towards my older child. I was so unwell that really I was in kind of survival mode. So there was like a biological imperative that kicked in, and it was prioritise the newborn, then yourself, and then unfortunately for my son, which I'll feel forever guilty about, he was third in line when he should have been first or second. But I have to remind myself I was really ill and I didn't get any help.
What about now? What's it like for you as a mother now? How does it impact your parenting?
It's very different now, obviously, because my son's 16 and a half now. My daughter's just turned 14. They know that I have bipolar, and they know quite a lot about that and what it is and what it means. And they get quite irritated if they see in the media some incorrect or inappropriate use of the word, or that people don't really understand what it means, but they're using the word anyway. I try still not to let them see me when I'm in distress, because even though they're teenagers, I think it's really important that I'm still the mum, the parent, the adult.
How can you do that, though? Because they're both still living at home, I presume.
My daughter's actually with my ex-husband. Right. My son's with me. It's all quite amicable, but that's just the way it's worked out. I hide. I hide when I'm really distressed.
But can you be a parent and hide? Surely being a parent means being there for a child 24/7.
Yeah, if you had a 16-year-old, you'd know it's quite difficult to get them out of their bedroom.
Okay.
So that gives me a lot more hiding space. A few years ago, it was a lot more difficult. On the way here, I was thinking about Christmas 3 years ago and how I had one of those unpleasant little highs. And I was just so anxious. I was, didn't know what to do with myself, so agitated, like having a day-long panic attack. And that was on Christmas Eve, and that was really dire because I felt like I had to make it nice for the kids because it was Christmas Eve. But in fact, I was just desperate. So I kept saying, you know, have some mince pies, then running into the bedroom and kind of having a bit more of a panic attack and a cry, sorting myself out, coming out, doing that all through the day. It was awful.
And we are going to come back to the Christmas and the effects it has a bit later on in the show. But so I'm interested, Charlotte, what sort of advice would you give to prospective parents who have mental health conditions?
People ask me a lot, as you can imagine, and it is one of the biggest decisions you can ever make. Somebody once said to me that parenting with mental health is like extreme parenting because you've got all these really difficult tensions and conflicts and anxieties that most people don't have. But for most people, the decision whether to have a child or not is big enough. But when you've got all that stuff on top, if I was doing it again now, I wouldn't do it in any way like the way I did before.
Would you have children if you...
Oh, definitely. But I would be in treatment and I would stay in treatment. I wasn't in treatment. I avoided treatment because I'd been told that the only drug that was offered to me could cause heart defects in a fetus, so I shouldn't get pregnant. So I kind of ran away because getting pregnant felt more important for my long-term life than being on meds right then. But I would feel very, very differently now. I would want a specialist support team on hand, really, with specialist midwives and specialist psychiatrists.
Thank you, Charlotte. We're now going to bring back in Kevin to talk about bullying online.
Are you still there, Kevin?
Yes, first of all, congratulations, Charlotte, on your award.
Thank you so much.
Cyber and face-to-face bullying came into focus in November during Anti-Bullying Week, and recent figures have suggested that 81% of people with autistic spectrum disorders have experienced some form of abuse online. That means that is an incredibly high figure, and 24% say that they've been bullied online.
Now, Kevin, you're on the spectrum, aren't you? And you've been campaigning against the bullying of people with autism since April this year. Why have you made this your mission? Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, well, I've been a campaigner now for 13 years since I got diagnosed back in 2000. And I started this other campaign in April. You know, I've been campaigning for others on the autistic spectrum. But this one, I'm finding where I'm actually campaigning for myself and for many others as well who are on the spectrum.
In what ways have you been bullied over the years then?
Oh, from childhood, from, you know, I remember from, you know, leaving nursery school, getting into preschool, being bullied at preschool, then being bullied in juniors and being bullied in seniors, then leaving school, getting on the internet, you know, the technology age, and being bullied online, where it's been so extreme. I've had cyberbullying, trolling, my Twitter account cloned, I've been impersonated, I've received a death threat.
Tell us about the death threat.
This was through Twitter. This person got hold of my email. Obviously, for legal reasons, I can't mention which country it's from, but it's from a European country. And I opened my inbox one morning, and it said, "Kevin, we're going to send a hit squad over to finish you off."
Oh my gosh.
I mean, how did you react to this?
Well, as an autistic person, I take things very literally. This was quite a direct threat, and obviously it really upset me. I'd shut down my computer and I couldn't go online for like weeks and weeks and weeks.
What is it about having autism that makes somebody like yourself more affected by this bullying?
I think it's more intrusive. Let's say, for example, if we take autism out of the box, and if it's somebody who isn't on the autistic spectrum and they're being bullied, they probably have different coping mechanisms how to cope with the bullying. But when somebody's got autism, you know, we have lots of problems with anxiety, we can have depression, lots of things come into play. So, you know, it affects our sensory issues, our anxiety, our confidence, and it affects us in so many ways. So with the bullying campaign, I want laws changing. I want the current hate crime law in the UK to be changed.
Why do you think you've been targeted yourself so specifically?
That's a good question. I don't know. I've got about 120,000 followers on Twitter. I'm an active campaigner. I think people see my vulnerable side of me. Mm. They just go in for the attack. You know, I've had people actually cloning my profile and pretending to be me and sending out the most awful tweets you can imagine. And I've contacted, you know, social media sites about this. I've contacted the police in other countries, and because of the cross-border international laws, there's nothing they can do. So at the moment, I've got an MEP, Phil Bennion, who's actually taken the campaign over to Europe, and I've got Ian Mearns, who's an MP for Gateshead, who's actually debated it in Parliament. It's gone through a 10-minute rule bill, and it's been heard again on the 24th of January. So if that gets through that stage, it can go through, you know, possibly to the House of Lords for a bill. We've got 23 high-profile celebrities backing the campaign. We've got people like who've got autistic children themselves, like Katie Price, Melanie Sykes, Keith Duffy, Emma Noble. They're all backing the campaign. Mm. We've got Lord Sugar involved. He kindly offered us help. And we got a billboard campaign across the UK, which was seen by 30 million people, which was absolutely amazing. We're trying to get another second billboard campaign launched, hopefully in London in January, which will feature myself and two parents, which I've got two autistic children at a very young age. And one of the things which I really fear for, and, you know, I turn 40 next year, I really fear for the younger generation who've got disabilities and also who've got autism, who go online. Because some of these children, you know, I'm very literal. I take things very literally even today as a grown adult. And I really fear that these young children who go online could actually end up taking their own lives.
Well, if you want to find out more about Kevin's campaign, which does have over 100 MPs at the moment pledging support, the website is www.autism-campaign.co.uk. I'm going to bring Charlotte back, who's been very patiently waiting with us.
Hi.
Let's go back to this thorny, and I don't just mean the mistletoe, topic of Christmas. And we should at this point, if you can hear some slight rattling of bells, can you... That is Kate's quite absurdly festive
Christmas
jumper. Maybe
Christmas
you can
jumper.
Describe it to everybody.
I'd love to describe it to you, Rob.
Not it's, in too much detail.
It's a lovely black jumper with a little kitten on it with some jingly bells for the people who can't enjoy the sight of it. And man, I love Christmas. Don't you just love Christmas, Rob?
Honestly, I find Christmas incredibly difficult
for many
reasons, not all of them disability related, but a lot of it is essentially, if you're an albino, as I am, and the whole kind of visual overload of the whole thing, it can be quite nauseating.
Oh.
Baubles, tinsel and whatever. I find myself getting blinded by excessive amounts of foil in people's homes and in public places.
I love that you're trying to use your disability as a reason why you're a Grinch.
I'm also a Scrooge as well. Yeah, it's mainly due to the fact that I think let's get Charlotte and Kevin's opinion on this. Let's go into this a little bit more, Charlotte. Why is this not the most wonderful time of year for you?
Well, the thing is, with bipolar, one year you can be fine, and the next year you're not. So I don't ever know. As it comes towards the end of the year, I kind of take a bit of an assessment. This year I'm a bit worried. Last year was fine. I just don't know. And the other kind of bizarre thing about bipolar is it doesn't have to be bad stress to knock me off course and make me unwell. It can be good stress as well. So a lot of good, exciting, happy things happening around Christmas has the potential to make me go high, whereas being, say, lonely, family conflict, something like that, has the potential to make me go low. So any way around it can be a bit of a minefield.
Kevin, so does this erratic Christmas behaviour or ring any jingle bells with you?
Oh, Joe, I just hate Christmas. I can't. And the reason why I hate it is because somebody suffering from, and I've just used that word suffering, I don't like even use like the word suffering. As a person living with autism, I find it very difficult. I find the old thing around Christmas, a sensory, you know, I don't go shopping, I don't do Christmas shopping.
I mean, what do you think about giving and receiving presents, Kevin?
I like presents. I don't like actually opening the presents because I don't like the sensory of feeling the paper, the wrapping paper, it makes a noise. I don't like the Christmas trees up. I don't like the lights. I don't like the sensory things around. Believe it or not, people think I'm probably Scrooge, but I'm not. But in my own house, I don't have any Christmas decorations up at all.
Why don't you like the decorations and the trees and stuff?
It's too much. It's overwhelming. I've got two pet cats and I had a tree up about 7 years ago and they attacked the tree. The tree came down and the lights went everywhere and everything. And I just thought, you know, pack everything away.
Okay,
and...
but what about Christmas dinner? Surely we can all agree on the turkey. The turkey is brilliant.
Yes, that's the only thing I look forward to is the Christmas dinner. And that's the only time I actually get to sit down with my mum and dad and my twin brother.
There we go. What about you, Charlotte?
I love Christmas dinner.
Yes.
I cook it. And for me, part of the day is that time I get on my own in the kitchen.
We'll all come Charlotte's Christmas dinner. Then.
Yeah. What about you, Rob? Come on, Christmas dinner.
No,
yes.
I don't like Christmas dinner.
Oh,
at all.
No.
Surely.
No, I did last year. I went to a restaurant with my family and I had Dover sole and a bottle
goodness.
Of Sancerre. And it was great.
You are a hopeless case, Rob. Okay.
Well, so, Christmas dinner, everyone likes it except me. Christmas in every other respect. Actually, it's just you, Kate.
Yeah, fine. I'll be on my own in my Christmas joy with my Christmas jumper. Anyway, we were deadly serious when we mentioned last month that the Ouch Talk Show is looking for correspondents. So if you have expertise in an area of disability life and fancy taking part in the show, we want to hear from you. So tweet us at BBC Ouch or email at ouch@bbc.co.uk.
Who do you want a correspondent on?
I would quite like a disabled toilet correspondent. I think that would be good. Or perhaps a disability weather correspondent.
Disability weather?
Someone who's going to tell me that it's, you know, warm and sunny, so my joints are going to be good, or cold and miserable.
But wouldn't just an ordinary weather forecaster
No,
be able to
they
do
have
that?
To be a disability specific one, of course. What would you like?
Anyone who knows a lot about monkeys.
Disabled monkeys or any
preferably,
monkeys?
But any monkey will do, but particularly home help monkeys.
Okay, right.
So let's say thank you very much once again to Charlotte and Kevin. It's been a pleasure to have you on the programme.
Thank you
very much.
Ouch.
Talking disability.
I need to limit how much I watch something like X Factor because it can make me delusional and think that, oh, I can maybe be a singer or I can get this record deal. I think anyone with schizophrenia needs to be careful about how much they watch of these things. I know lots of people with schizophrenia who say that they feel that they're getting messages from things they watch on TV, particularly from reality shows.
bbc.co.uk/ouch.
Now, I have the very exciting news that Hannah Cockcroft is on the line with us right now. Hannah, hello.
Hello.
So, Hannah, what does Christmas mean to you? Are you a Grinch like Rob, or do you embrace the joy like I do?
I love Christmas.
Yay!
Christmas is... Yeah.
I knew you were going to.
It's kind of the only time I get to spend with my family, so it's just a nice time of year where I can relax a little bit and just chill with my family and see them. So
exactly, my point exactly.
Now, Hannah won gold twice at London 2012, leaving her nearest rivals seconds behind and earning her the nickname Hurricane Hannah for her sheer speed in a racing chair. Then she became a glamorous celeb overnight. Now, more than a year has passed since those heady days, but Hannah Lucy Cockcroft, MBE, continues breaking records, adding new strings to her bow and awards to her no-doubt creaking mantelpiece, plus an appearance on the upcoming Sport Relief edition of Strictly Come Dancing. So we've been asking our guests the killer question, which is, if you had the choice, would you get rid of your disability? And what's your answer to that?
No, absolutely not. I mean, you know, I have done probably more things with a disability than I would without it, and I've definitely had more exciting opportunities than my friends, and I definitely wouldn't have this life if I didn't have my disability with it. So
that's
no
someone
way
with a
I
definitive answer.
I like
we've had
it.
So much fence sitting with everybody
but
else
the thing
we've asked.
Is, if your disability was going to get you on Strictly Come Dancing, I don't think anyone would give it away. So, Hannah, I have to ask the question that is on everybody's lips. Who will you be dancing with on
I am
Strictly?
Dancing with Pasha.
Oh,
and,
the
he's a lovely
Pasha.
Guy. I really like him.
Oh, you lucky thing. And are you enjoying it?
I'm really enjoying it. It's quite hard work and it's quite tiring. And I'm training at the same time, of course, for racing as well. So
you're fitting in, obviously, your training, your dancing, yeah. And then you're also doing a journalism degree. Is that right?
I am, yep, doing it all at the same time. So back up to university tonight to come back down in the morning for more dance rehearsals.
How do you fit it all in?
I just don't sleep, I think is the answer.
Sleep's overrated.
One year on now, what are your abiding memories of London 2012?
Probably my favourite memory is for the 200 metres, so my second race, it was the only race that I did with another Brit on the line. And the other Brit happened to be my best friend, Mel Nichols. So, you know, racing against my best friend, but then she also came on the glory lap with me. So we managed to, I mean, for my first race, I was a little bit confused about what I was supposed to do, so I rushed that glory lap. We took 45 minutes on this glory lap, which is probably the longest 400 metres I've ever done, but it was so incredible having that reception for all that time and just making the most of it. I absolutely loved it. So that and seeing Coldplay at the closing ceremony, that was pretty awesome.
You basically became a celebrity almost overnight. So what's been your favourite celebrity moment? And have you been waving those gold medals around to get yourself upgraded on trains and into nightclubs and things?
No, I haven't used my gold medals for anything like that. I never want to carry them around because they're quite heavy. So if I ever get the chance, I'll just leave them at home. But, favourite memory? I don't know. I've had too many amazing opportunities. I've been to the National Television Awards and I went to Pride of Britain last year and obviously Sports Personality of the Year. I did a photo shoot for Marie Claire, which I guess every 21-year-old would love to do.
If I Google Hannah Cockcroft, some of the top things that come up are Hannah Cockcroft, FHM, and Hannah Cockcroft boyfriend. So clearly these are the things that people want to know about. First of all, do you have a boyfriend? And second of all, have you actually done FHM?
Yes, I do have a boyfriend. I'm with Sam Ruddock, who's a sprinter on the team. And no, I haven't been an FHM. The FHM thing, for London 2012, they kind of did an online vote of the three sexiest Paralympians. And I came out top, which my dad wasn't too happy about. But I really quite liked it. I thought it was very funny, but it also shows that, you know, if a magazine like that can recognise Paralympians in the same way that they look at kind of all women, then it shows a massive step forward and it shows that there isn't, you know, such a gap in the market. So, but no, I haven't been in a magazine, in case my dad's listening.
Yeah, nice. You've talked about your having quite bad acne and stuff before when you were younger. What's it like being in the public eye and body image and all of that kind of thing? And you have people voting on how you look.
Yeah, I mean, I've always had bad acne. I still have it now. And London 2012, you know, my skin was actually loads better than it had been for a long time, so I was quite happy with it. But people hide behind online personas, and all the comments on pictures were kind of like, oh, she'd be so pretty if she had nice skin. And then what people don't understand is acne isn't something you can change. It's kind of like hereditary, so it's a little bit like a disability. You can't like get rid of it that easily. As an athlete, you're going out there every day and people expect you to look perfect all the time and really fit and healthy. And, you know, something like acne, you can't get rid of by eating right or sleeping the right amount or training loads. You know, it's just going to be there all the time. And people don't know that. So it is quite hard sometimes. You always have to feel like you look perfect. But everything else in my body I'm happy about. And, you know, if people can be that judgmental, then they can't say it to your face.
Do you think you're a role model?
A role model?
Do you want to be a role model?
I don't think I'm one. I find it really strange when people say you're inspirational because I'm just doing something that I really, really love to do. And so, you know, if people could draw inspiration from that, then that's fantastic and that's amazing. And if you've inspired one person, and then as a Paralympian, that's your job done because you've just kind of helped create the person who's going to come up and be the next you. But I don't really want to be a role model because then people are going to kind of judge what you do even more.
True.
So are there any downsides, do you think, to being a young disabled woman in the public eye that you've discovered in the last sort of 18 months?
I think possibly the only downside, and it's more to do with being an athlete than it is being, you know, young and disabled, is the fact that I'm a student and I'm a fresher and I can't do any fresher things.
Snakebite is overrated in my opinion.
Do you find all your classmates are in awe of you and wanting your autograph?
No, I think it's really nice because when I moved into uni, one of my worries was, oh, everyone's going to be my friend because of who I am and because I've got a car and because I've got these gold medals. But actually, I moved in and no one knew who I was, so it was okay.
You'd be a little bit disappointed with that, wouldn't you, surely?
I don't know. I quite liked it. I noticed the difference between Coventry and going home, though, because in the streets of Coventry, I don't get recognised at all. But at home, I just all the time getting stopped, and I actually love it. So
I name all of my cars, and I hear that you name all your wheelchairs. What are some of the names that you've given your chairs?
My race chair at the moment is called Sally.
Nice.
My first
any
race
reason?
Chair was called Oscar. I always seem to name them after runners, Paralympic runners, just because the chairs, a bit like my legs. So Sally is named after one of my best friends on the team, Sally Brown. And then Oscar, obviously, was named after Oscar Pistorius. And then I had Ian in between them two, who was named after another runner called Ian Jones. So
nice.
It's just a strange thing I do. I don't know why.
You tweeted recently, I spotted it, about learning to tie your own shoelaces.
Yeah, I did.
So congratulations. Why was this so difficult before now?
Part of my disability, because of the brain damage I have, it means that I have problems with my fine motor skills. So just doing small, complicated things with my fingers, I just literally can't do it. And one of my friends at university, she did the same as everyone. She kind of watched me do what I used to do on my shoelaces, which was kind of just like mash them together like your earphones would in your pocket. And she was like, "What are you doing?" And I was like, "My shoelaces." And she came back like a couple of days later and she was like, "Why don't you try it like this?" So it was a completely different and new way, but we managed to do it after a couple of hours just sat on the floor just with all my shoes lined up. I managed to tie my shoelaces.
So long, slip-on shoes. So what's next for Hannah Cockcroft in 2014?
2014, carrying on at uni. We've got European Championships in Swansea in August. So I hope to add the European Champion to my list of titles because it's the one that I don't yet hold. Extending my distances, so I'm going to be racing the 800 metres at the Europeans too. So lots of challenges and lots of exciting things coming up.
And if you do need work experience as part of your journalism degree, you're very welcome to come into Ouch, by the way. Because I'd love to have a gold medalist make me tea. Milk and no sugar. And thank you very much, Hannah, for coming in to join us. And very best of luck.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ouch. Talking disability.
I got talent spotted to go into the rifle shooting team. And then I was put on the squad. But then I quit. And the reason I quit is because I've never had any other disabled mates. There weren't people at my secondary school. So it's quite weird to suddenly find myself pigeonholing myself as disabled. I had a real issue with it. I had to go into like counselling and all sorts.
bbc.co.uk/ouch.
Disability organisations say that disabled people don't get good sex education. To bring this to the public attention, Enhance the UK have produced a calendar of nude disabled people. Joining us from that organisation is Jenny Williams.
Also with us to talk about sex education for disabled people more broadly, we've got dating expert and stroke survivor Sam Van Rood and Claire Murphy Morgan and Victoria Thirkle from theatre group Them Wifeys. So let's start with you two then, Claire and Victoria. Can you introduce us to Them Wifeys?
We're an arts organisation based in Newcastle and we've been going since 1979 and we use a range of creative arts initiatives and approaches to working with people who are disenfranchised or disadvantaged. And a big part of what we do is we work with people with learning disabilities. And Josephine and Jack Project is our current project working with people with learning disabilities.
And who are Jack and Josephine?
Josephine and Jack are two life-size anatomically correct cloth people and they're very much characters in their own right. Mm-hmm. And they're drama-based resources for sex and relationships education, specifically made by and tailored for adults and young people with learning disabilities.
So why is this kind of training actually necessary then? Do learning disabled adults not get to know about the birds and the bees? Do their parents not sit them down and give them, you know, that awkward, hideous talk
the
that we
talk.
All have to go through?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's changing. I think it's getting better, but there's still enormous gaps in terms of sexual health and education provision. And I think one of the main barriers for a lot of people with learning disabilities is that it's reams and reams of written and technical information that is then very difficult to retain that information. It's often not explained in a way that people can understand.
So what is it that you guys do differently then?
Victoria, do you want to say a little bit about Josephine and what she does?
Yes. When I first got the letter from me doctors to have a smear test, I went with my stepmom, Anne, but unfortunately she passed away last September. And I had to go with Anne the first time. It was a bit uncomfortable, and then I went to see Westlife at the Telly West Arena.
Excellent, yeah. A good choice.
And then I went for the second one, and I'd done a workshop with people with learning disabilities.
With Josephine.
Yeah. And Josephine helped us through the second one.
So what Josephine does is, so she has a thinking and feeling head where you can place questions or thoughts in her head. She has a detachable breast you can feel for lumps. She's got her own reproductive organs and a baby and a thoughts and feelings bag where we have a range of drama tools that we take out of that bag. So one of those tools Josephine has is a diary. For example, in the workshop that Victoria's just talked about, Josephine gets a letter inviting her to go for a smear test, and she's not sure what a smear test is. So we use within the drama Josephine setting a range of different drama and role-playing techniques to explore how she feels about a smear test, why a smear test might be quite important and beneficial thing for women to have. And then we actually follow the procedure of Josephine going for a smear test. And we use a very similar set of drama-based tools in looking at, for example, Josephine writes in her diary that she's met a young man at college that she really quite likes and she's quite attracted to. How does she then go about talking to him, getting to know him a little bit better? It's quite a holistic approach, so we don't just come in with all the technical information about this is sex, this is contraception. It's using a range of different scenarios, which then allows women or young women to explore in that setting how they feel.
Jenny, I'm going to move it back to you. I mean, these seem like quite unconventional approaches to sex ed for disabled people that Claire and Victoria have been talking about. Is it really necessary for it to be so different as sex ed would be for non-disabled people, do you think?
Well, we're coming from a slightly different angle, really, because Claire and Victoria are very much concentrating on people with learning difficulties, whereas where Enhancer UK are coming from, and we're working alongside Brooke, who are sex education providers who work sister to Family Planning Association, is actually looking at sex education for people with physical disabilities. And actually, the more research that we did, we found that there is actually more support groups for people with learning disabilities, you know, around sex education, but there is actually nothing out there for people with physical disability. What we're wanting to do is to actually talk to mainstream able-bodied children in mainstream schools and disabled children and say, how do you feel about your sex education? Can disabled people have sex? What's your reaction? And a lot of the people that we know, a lot of adults, when we mention what Enhance does, they the automatic thing that people say is, God, I've never even thought about that. I've never even thought there'd be barriers or disabled people would want to have sex, especially when you're in a care home, for example.
You're considered to be sexually retired. Is this the assumption?
Well, I think so. And I think people are very babyfied, especially if something's happened to you and you've got to have a carer to look after you. You're suddenly not seen as a sexual being. And we obviously all know that that's not true. But lots of people who don't have a disability or never had anything to do with disability don't know that that's not true. So the long-winded answer is we don't actually know, and that's part of this project. We want to talk to mainstream children and able-bodied children because so many mainstream schools now have children with physical disabilities in their schools, and we want to make it inclusive.
On your website, it says disability isn't sexy. I mean, I would disagree with that. I think disability is sexy.
No, it's saying this is the perception. People aren't seeing it as sexy, so therefore we're not doing anything about it. That's what we want to change.
Well, what about this calendar then? Tell us.
Well, we're all
that.
Very sexy in our calendar.
Exactly.
It was really, really good fun to make, and I didn't have any problem getting people to jump on board and get involved and get their clothes off.
And is it all in the best possible taste?
Very tasteful.
I have a copy. Obviously, it's in the radio, but I do have a copy here that you can have a look at later.
You know what? I am going to do that later.
I don't quite trust my initial
reactions to things like that.
Well, I'm having a quick look, and I can definitely say, yeah, disabled people are sexy. Yeah.
Okay.
Steamy.
Done.
Steamy.
And what's the money? Where's the money going to go from the copy sold of this?
The money is all going to supporting the campaign, which is called Undressing Disability. So it's going to be supporting the project, and also we're going to come onto a bit later, but the Love Lounge that we're going to be setting up.
Okay. I mean, I'm just flicking through the calendar as we speak, and we've got a naked guy in a taxi. We've got a naked lady just in her pants with with her hands covering her modesty for February there.
I'm really glad I'm visually impaired.
Yeah, that is me.
This is not the kind of calendar that I would put up where my parents could see it. Let's put it like that.
We were in a double page spread actually last week in the Bucks Herald, and my mum and dad live in Aylesbury, and they had no warning that that was going to happen. And apparently my dad did open the paper and spit his coffee out over it. And my mum said he's very proud, darling, but a little bit embarrassed.
I think that's how my parents would react as well.
So, Sam, you're the GMTV Love Doctor, which is how you became known to so many of us here in the UK.
I love that title.
Indeed. Now, you're somebody who became disabled later in life through having a stroke. How long ago was that?
That was 5 years ago now.
Are you surprised that sex education for this group is such a complex issue?
Well, I'm not actually, because getting, for instance, rehab, it's a really hit and miss thing. It's a postcode lottery. Like, I just happen to be near the best stroke rehab unit probably in the country. And because of that, I've made really good progress in my rehab and I'm back to a normal life. But I've talked to a lot of people who just, the most basic stuff, which I just took for granted, they don't even get.
What sort of things?
Well, it's things like physiotherapy, intensive physiotherapy. So, for instance, when you first start out, if they don't get you walking within 6 months, just forget about walking for the rest of your life. And I talked to some people who weren't even getting physiotherapy because they lived in the wrong part of London or something like that. Something else which is actually more serious is mental health treatment. A lot of people who have strokes end up with depression, which can be a very dangerous condition, you know, life-threatening. And they didn't pick up that I had depression. And I didn't end up actually getting a psychiatrist until I'd overdosed, you know. So I had to almost try and kill myself to get the right sort of treatment. Now, that is outrageous. So it doesn't surprise me at all that maybe in some places people who are disabled might get sex education. But the point is unless someone, you know, people like Enhance go out there and really push for it, it probably won't happen.
Is it be a case then you would have liked some sort of rehab to help you with the change in your sex life, I suppose, which may have occurred after the stroke while you're in that recovery?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, I was very forward in asking that my wife and I could have a private room where we could, you know, enjoy ourselves and have a normal sex life while I was recovering. That wasn't offered. We had to really ask for it. And initially they're a bit like, oh my God, that's too much. And they freaked out quite a bit. And then once they calmed down, they gave us the do not disturb signs and it was fine.
And how did it go? I mean, I don't want to go into too much detail, but
Was fine. It was actually, that was absolutely fine. And there was no problem there. I mean, the thing that was really difficult actually is that then afterwards, and this is where the kind of complexity comes in, is that because I was depressed and I was put onto antidepressants, it meant that the antidepressants, as it does with a lot of people, SSRIs can really wreck your sex life. That happened to me, and so I've now had to spend a lot of time kind of seeing therapists and stuff to try and get everything working. You know, just put crudely, I can fly the flag, but I can't fire the cannon.
SSRIs being antidepressants.
Antidepressants, exactly. And that's a very common side effect. But no one talked about that to me. The doctors didn't help me through it. So
it seems like the answer is to just be, if you're in a situation like yours, is to being exceptionally pushy.
Be pushy. Don't wait for help. Push. Get your friends and your family and be pushy. That is the key, is you've got to be pushy. Don't be shy.
Victoria, can I be personal and ask if you have a boyfriend at the moment?
No, I haven't at the moment, no.
But has Josephine sort of helped you understand the feelings involved and understand
yes.
sex?
Yes.
And is that a good thing?
Yes, I think it's a good thing, yeah. Our view is it doesn't matter whether you're in a relationship or you're not. It's the right to have access to that information in a way that is accessible to you and is easy to understand.
Now, Jenny, you've got some horror stories, I would imagine, about lack of education in sexual health.
You heard from a young deaf girl who talked about not having any sex education at her school.
unfortunately, I know so many stories about deaf community, and this is another massive thing as well. They get very, very left out. People forget that the deaf community, a lot of deaf people can't read a lot of English. The grammar structure that they write in is BSL if they're born deaf. And, you know, one girl was, you know, sexually abused for a long time because she didn't understand that that wasn't the right thing to do. We've heard of people using, deaf people using, not just deaf people, these are the case studies, using crisp packets as condoms, trying to do that because they didn't know. And they don't know to go online and necessarily read all the, because there's reams of written information in English. We need BSL interpreted information on all of these websites as well. It's so important.
And bringing this issue into focus, it's had an unexpected consequence for Enhance the UK. Can you tell us what you're planning for the website in the new year?
So we're now going to be setting up the Love Lounge in January, which is essentially a platform and a way for people to write in and talk to Sam and get advice if they want to. And we've also got a guy called Andy from America, and he has got cerebral palsy and he's gay. So we're going to have somebody for our gay members to speak to as well.
So Sam, what kind of questions are you expecting on there?
Well, I mean, I expect actually probably a lot of the questions will be similar to what I got when I just dealt with able-bodied people, actually, is a lot about the basics, because what's really interesting about able body and around love and sex and dating is a lot of people are really quite clueless about it. And it's like driving. It's really simple. You know, there are kind of red lights saying stop, there are green lights saying go, there's orange saying, you know, I maybe. And you need to understand those signals. And a lot of, certainly a lot of able-bodied people are clueless about that. So I imagine a lot of disabled people will be clueless about that. But I think also a lot of it might be about confidence issues, about who's going to want me now. You know, I certainly had that feeling after the stroke. I just thought, God, who would want someone who just can't function anymore? And I, because I'm a trained dating expert, I noticed that there are all these hot young nurses who were flirting with me like mad, and I was just gobsmacked. I was like, you know, I believe the evidence. And I was thinking, my God, I must be sexually attractive still. This is amazing. Hurrah! And had to turn down several offers, actually.
Which surprised me even more.
Exactly.
NHS nurses, they're allowed to ask patients out on dates these days?
Well, they're not allowed to,
I'll
but
be,
they do.
Checking in there
they
later.
Do. Yeah. But I mean, the thing is that they're, you know, they're single women, they're human beings like everyone else, but they work really hard all the time. And so they don't actually get an opportunity to meet many men. So,
that's,
you know,
true.
You know, I was talking about this to a friend of mine who's a nurse, and I'd said it, and she said to me, well, stranger things have happened on my rounds.
Indeed so.
So I imagine actually there are probably quite a few disabled people who don't realise that either able-bodied or other disabled people are actually attracted to them. And if you've never seen it and you've never felt it, you probably just feel invisible and unattractive. So I imagine there'll be a lot of stuff like that. But also simple things like, you know, what Jenny was saying, like, oh, you know, I'm in a care home, how do I get a double bed? You know, what are the mechanics? How do I do it?
Very quickly, how do you get involved with Enhance the UK?
Well, we're really looking for more bloggers. That's a big thing. We've got lots of people blogging for us at the moment, but we want to hear what you guys think and are feeling. And already, right, if you want to talk to Sam...
And we want to hear what
questions that you have, and we can preempt to start the Love Lounge going in January.
And I have to ask you both the killer question before we go as well. So I'll start with Jenny. If you could change your life and not have your disability, would you do it?
Absolutely not. And I'm not just saying that for effect. I've always said that because I wouldn't be doing this. I wouldn't be here now. I wouldn't know Sam. Wouldn't have my boyfriend. Wouldn't be running Enhance. No, absolutely wouldn't change it.
And Sam?
That is really tricky, actually. It's really difficult. I mean, actually, I am a much better person because of what's happened to me. And so in that way, no. But physically, if I could have my... You know, I really miss... I was a very physical person. I used to be a rock climber and so on, and I desperately miss that. So I would love to have that back, but if I could have that back and, you know, somehow become a better person as well. But for what I've learned, I would say no. Like, I'm actually happier now after I've recovered from my disability than before, you know. And I've always heard people say that, and I thought it's bollocks. But, you know, actually, having experienced, I'm like, wow, you know, and...
Let's throw the question up to Newcastle. Victoria, if you could remove your disability, would you do it?
I don't think so. Because question asked like that before.
It's an unusual question.
It's an unusual question.
It's definitely a difficult one.
Yeah. It's a difficult one, yes.
Do you think you would be a different person or a similar person, Victoria, if you didn't have a learning disability?
Probably similar.
You'd be similar?
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Claire and Victoria up in Newcastle and Sam and Jenny in the studio with us. We've really enjoyed it. But Rob, I think we're going to have to kill your killer question. I know you love it, but I just can't bear another month of this, I'm afraid.
Has it been flogged to death?
What do you mean for one shot?
But nobody can answer it. It's too hard.
Nobody asked me.
Would you get rid of your disability?
I was
going to
ask you, actually.
It changes from day to day. Sometimes I think yes, sometimes I think no.
Lovely. Thank you very much.
Thank you to you all.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, that's it for this month. Thank you for listening. We're on Facebook, Twitter, email, and any other social network you can think of. And there's even clips of past shows up on Audioboo for your delight. We are everywhere. Get in touch and tell us what you think or who you'd like to hear us interview and why.
And thanks to all our guests and the team, Damon Rose and James Rogers, who took the photos today. Our studio manager was Phil Hutchinson, and the show was produced by Emma Tracy.
Playing us out is Finian, the 11-year-old with Asperger's, who's hoping for a Christmas number one with a song he wrote himself last year for a school concert. Here he is with Spirit of Christmas.
And we'll be back in early 2014 with a New Year special. What's special about it? Frankly, we've no idea.
We don't know yet.
We're working on it. Give us a chance. It's Christmas. Until then, goodbye.
Bye-bye.
How many people have enjoyed a big hill and a sleigh? Christmas is